thought. Now we should be all right. And looks like everything is fine.
Good.
Okay, let's just begin by indicating that today is February 8th, 1995. And this is Jim Boning speaking with Dr. Norman Hackerman at his office at the University of Texas in Austin. As I indicated, this particular interview is designed by the Electrochemical Society in terms of talking to its past presidents, and we have an agenda that you have in front of you that I just sort of like to go through, beginning with your origins of interest in electrochemistry. And I know you and I have talked about that briefly before, mm-hmm. but maybe we could just review that for this purpose.
Sure.
Now.
Well, let me give you a little background. At the time, I was at Hopkins, and you may have read someplace that there was a deep depression, so there was no rush to get out of the university, although I did get my degree in 3 years in the bachelor's. But I was doing two problems. One of them had to do with electrokinetic potentials, an electrophoresis problem. Another one had to do with sulfur monochloride, not related to electrochemistry. And somewhere along the line, I got interested in why the oxygen electrode wasn't reversible. We still can't make a reversible oxygen electrode. And I tried to do things with graphite. Had I known about fullerenes, I might have used them. But I got interested in electrochemistry by virtue of this irreversibility of the oxygen electrode. And that was in about 1935-36. It was followed by an early interest in some corrosion problems, which came, I think, from a consultancy arrangement. I'm not sure about that. And it was about that time that I became aware of the Electrochemical Society.
Was that through a professor, or was it? Were you aware when you were still a student?
I was still a student and just transferring into non-student care, finishing.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't remember whether Dr. Patrick, the fellow with whom I worked, was aware of the Electrochemical Society or not. The other people on the faculty I know were not.
Okay.
He might have been. But I suspect it was because I began looking in abstracts to see what I could find out about the oxygen electrode, and I saw numerous references to the Transactions of the American Electrochemical Society, as it was then called. And that's what I think is the origin.
Okay.
I can't remember an electrochemist in my background,
okay.
my student background. So it probably was self-induced. It was in the second half of the 1930s, and it was instigated by this oxygen electrode problem.
When did you, you mentioned this earlier, not sure when you first joined the society, but what?
It was in the 40s.
In the 40s.
Yeah, okay. It was in the 40s. And again, I find it difficult to remember whether it was before I came to this place or not. But I do know that I think the first paper I published came out of here in 1946. Now, I remember that pretty well because I was interested in the passivity of chromium. The paper is called something like Electrolytic Corrosion of Chromium or something like that. It was in the Transactions of the American Electrochemical Society, 1946, and the student was Don Marshall, D.I. Marshall.
Okay.
That's the first tangible evidence I have of being in the society. I think I joined before that, but I really can't tell. I know I joined before that because, say, I've been in 50 years, and from
that would be 44. So
yeah,
or early.
At least 44 or earlier.
Right.
I developed a fairly good interest in corrosion while I was at VPI. 40, 41, 42, part of 43, and so I probably joined at that time. And I do remember that chromium paper because I'm beginning to get a little recall. It was the first paper I delivered personally.
Okay.
On my own. I was the chief in this case. I had to do it. And I came from here because I used these Southern Pacific Railroad through San Antonio to New Orleans and then Birmingham. The meeting was in Birmingham, Alabama. And the format at that time was the format that the Fire Society used. You presented a paper, and there was a discussion afterwards, and then the whole thing appeared as a transaction. That was the only way you could publish with the electric company side.
Didn't the paper have to be submitted and written in advance?
It had to be submitted in order to go on to the program.
Okay.
Some peer review process appeared or something. But you couldn't just submit it to the journal, because mm-hmm. there was no journal at the time.
Okay.
And I can remember the long train ride, and I can remember talking to the guy in the University of Alabama who had said who had discovered element 87, alabamium, which later was overturned.
Gary, you got an order.
Same guy did.
Do you mind if I
just... No, go ahead. Same guy did virginium and alabamium, I think. You remember 85 and 87?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And at least the guy who did the alabamium was one I talked to at the Birmingham meeting. And it was my first real contact with society close up. I'd been to American Chemical Society meetings, but when you went to them, you didn't see the president and the mm-hmm. editor and all. It was already not a very cozy kind of meeting. It wasn't as bad as it is now. But the American Electrochemical Society was different. This was a small group of maybe 200 people in one hotel, and they talked continuously, either formally or informally, for whatever number of days the meeting lasted, which I can't remember. So I was very much impressed by that.
Was there just a single session then of people giving papers?
I think there were no parallel sessions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they did dutifully, I don't know how they did it, whether with this or somebody transcribing it in shorthand or whatever. They took down everything that people said at in the discussion. That was all edited and the whole thing was published. Have you seen the early transactions?
No, I haven't seen the early transactions.
Well, it petered out shortly after, but from the time the society started in 1902 to 1948 or 49, it was all transactions.
Okay. How many other people did you meet at that time that you started making close contacts with?
Well, there were two people I remember particularly, maybe three. One of them was Bob Burns, who at the time was director of the chemical division of Bell Telephone Laboratories, a very prestigious position.
Know the name.
Yeah, Burns. Mm-hmm. Burns was a very able guy. He was a Princeton graduate, as I remember, PhD, and he was interested in materials. He's got a book on coatings. Mm-hmm. Or had a book on coatings. Another guy was Herb Ulig. Ulig was professor of metallurgy already, and had very high standing in the field of corrosion. He edited the corrosion handbook,
okay,
which still is to some extent a Bible type thing. And the third fellow that I got to know there was Frank LaQuey, who was vice president for research and development, I guess, at INCO, International Nickel, out of New York. Now, these three people had, established themselves pretty well. Remember, I was a newcomer, assistant professor here. And yet they were available. They sat and talked with you. And I'm sure there are others. The secretary of the society at the time, I can't remember his name right now.
A list of
he was at Columbia in chemical engineering. He'd been one of Colin Fink's students, I think. And he sure beat me up. kicked me all over the place for forgetting his name, but I'm sorry, I can't think of it.
I thought I'd find it in here, but I don't. Right away, there's a listing of all kinds of people, but I can't find the secretaries.
Back that far?
It's here somewhere.
It would be in the 40s. Anyway, those are the people I remember from that first contact. And I was pretty much impressed by him.
Well, we'll fill the name in. I just can't find it here off immediately.
Okay. And I've answered part of your four. It was a very homogeneous group of people. You know, they all had basically similar interests. There were already divisions, organic and electro organic and corrosion and something called physical electrochemistry. And let's see, what else was there? D&I, dielectric and insulation, that kind of thing. There are about a half dozen divisions, but the thing was so small that even though occasionally they might have had parallel sessions, most of the time everybody got together. And that was a nice thing about it. It was very noticeable relative to the ACS. Now you understand that the Electrochemical Society was not a spin-off of the ACS, but it was a breakaway. You know that story?
There's a little bit of it in here, but the ACS was reluctant to form a division of electrochemistry.
And Fink and Parsons didn't get along anyway.
Okay.
Not secondhand. I didn't know either of them directly. But secondhand says that there was a dispute, couldn't form a division, and Fink just seceded, I guess is the right word. There was another thing. The ACS at that time was pretty pure chemistry. I don't think they had any chemical engineering in it. I know they didn't have biochemistry because there wasn't any. In fact, there wasn't any chemical engineering when it formed. And the people who were in that in the first third of the century were chemists who enjoyed chemistry. And some of them, I know, got to the position of believing an application was dirty, it was prostitution. You know, and that still hangs on with some people. And electrochemistry at the time was predominant application. Plating, coating, corrosion, that kind of thing. All of them less than acceptable in pure chemical circles. So it was easier to break them away. And you'll notice that the ACS doesn't have a journal of electrochemistry. It gets closed. Langmuir puts stuff in and separates it out. And the Journal of Physical Chemistry does the same thing, but they don't attract the good papers. I shouldn't say they don't attract the better, you know, bulk of the good paper. So the society was a very nice place for a young guy to get involved. Of course, you could feel involved right at the beginning.
Would you say that the academics in the society were in the minority then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it had a sizable industrial leaning. Industrial electrochemistry was one of the divisions. Mm-hmm. Buffalo was a major site for meetings by virtue of the fact it was a center of electrochemical industry. Of course, the meetings were all in the northeast someplace, but they got to Buffalo about every fourth or fifth time. And the only place in the society that had pure chemistry was physical electrochemistry, which was the thing that I joined first.
Okay.
I mean, the division to which I adhered first, and then corrosion came later. And I developed a pretty close friendship with Burns and with Ulig and with Laqui, for that matter, and with some others. Bob Mears, who was research director at U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh. No, aluminum company in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Some others I can't think of right now. Morris Fontana, who was at Ohio State University at the time. All of these people were active. They were more, they were certainly less pure chemists than I was. So I held up the left wing of the society. But I had lots of interest in the application. I always thought that pure chemistry or pure science for its own sake was all right, but not for me. I preferred to have it tied to something. But when I got into that something, I tried to get as much purity as I could. When I got into the corrosion field, for example, word adsorption hadn't been used as far as I know. And when I attempted to explain inhibition, corrosion inhibition by adsorption phenomena, there was a certain amount of tutorialness I developed. But it did catch on, and I mean, it spread very quickly. And that, I'm not trying to say these guys didn't know what they're doing, but they just didn't have that same interest. But it was a very comfortable society right from the beginning. From the time I made this first trip in 1946, I pretty much went there not exclusively, but I stopped going to the others, to the ACS meetings, for example, except occasionally, because I retained an interest in non-charge transfer interface science, which meant that I had to go to the Calloway division of the ACS to get some of the things along. And the society has remained. It's more complex now, but it certainly remained that way for 20 years, and then it began to grow a little bit. And I enjoyed it. I went to every meeting, you know, twice a year meetings. When they asked me to do something, I did it. And that's one of your questions here. I have a reason for becoming active in society member activities. People asked me to do it, and I did it. That's all I know.
Okay.
Because I enjoy the people, and I enjoy the field. Mm-hmm. And I think I was president in 55 or 57, or something like that.
57.
So that was about 10 or 11 years after I got in with both feet, at least. And I'd done an awful lot of work in the meantime for them. It was easy to do. And they needed somebody to run for third vice president, so I said okay, and they got me. They still do it, third, the second, the first president.
Okay, that's the way it works.
And the president is the last year. Currently, I think the president stays on another year on the board, but then you rotate it off. So I rotated off in 57.
So you actually started that third vice presidency within 8 years or after you went to that first meeting?
Right, 57, 56, 54. Probably was elected in 54, so about 8 years.
Yeah.
But in about 49, Burns and Ulig got their heads together and decided that transactions was not the way to go, and that they had to go to a journal in the true sense of the word, where papers were submitted and accepted or rejected, published without discussion. And the society did go over to that, either in 49 or 50. Burns was the chairman of the publication committee, I think, and Ulig was the editor. They had a lot of trouble. They didn't get many manuscripts.
Hmm. Where were they going?
Well, I guess they began to spread out some. The National Association of Corrosion Engineers had started, so corrosion papers were going there.
Okay.
The industrial electric chemists were saying this is too esoteric for me. They're sort of getting out of the way. Journal of Physical Chemistry got a few of them at that time. It was called the Journal of Physical and Colloid Chemistry for a while. And the sequence is not certain, but in about 1951, I remember Ulig calling me and asked me if I would take on the job of technical editor. He would be editor and do the writing editorials and worrying about makeup and all the rest of it. And I would take, that would be sort of chairing the publication board, not the committee, but the peer review structure, which I did. So, and I did that till 1969, 20 years, at which time I became the editor. In fact, I've been the editor for a long time, in fact. After Ulig left, Cecil King of NYU became the editor. That's all, I think. Then I became editor. And I held that until 1989 or 90. So I was on that editorial activity from 51 to 90.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. And I did it through two presidencies, but I had a good lady working with me in each case. And the journal, which went through a trough, there was one issue that had three papers in it. Mm. And it probably was three out of four manuscripts that got through. But we began to talk it up at the Society because Society members were publishing elsewhere. And in about 2 years, it was back to being a full blast thing. The original size was that format. And we went to the full-size format, the 8.5 by 11. Probably by the time I was in the vice president's sequence, I did both of those at the same time. So I was president and technical editor at the time. And by the 60s, we were beginning to have the problem of, can we pay for this stuff? Institute of Page Charges, which we hadn't had before. We used to give away the reprints, which we had to start charging for. I remember we talked about advertising, and you know, it was an anathema to most of the people to go after advertising because that obviously is prostitution of a sort. But we did finally. And the journal now is a very robust journal. The society began to acquire interests which sort of came to the edge of, say, physical electrochemistry or dielectric and insulation. From dielectric and insulation, it wasn't hard to get to semiconductors. Mm-hmm. And first thing you know, we had lots of papers in that area, and we divided into electrochemistry and solid state, I think it's called. That's the way it's still set up.
At the time that it changed from transactions to the journal, did the meetings also change? That is,
yes.
You no longer had to submit a paper
in advance. You had to submit an abstract.
Abstract, but yeah. You didn't have to submit
right.
The...
And the divisions began to grow as interest in the field stirred up. You know, there's a philosophic difference between the way chemistry was prior to the big push in the 50s and following the Soviet space.
It was Sputnik.
Sputnik, yeah. Mm-hmm. The more people came into the field, the larger and larger was the percentage of people in the field who were interested in application. Since the Electrochemical Society had that kind of a cast to it, it began to grow pretty rapidly because, I don't know if it's because, but a reason could have been that at that time the purity of the chemistry in the ACS was not something that the new people wanted to talk about. They wanted to talk about use. And in fact, a lot of societies started up. The NACE started up at that time and other corrosion societies. So. The Electrochemical Society probably gained by virtue of the fact that there was a sizable influx into the field of chemistry and the field of science, for that matter. And those who had a better appreciation for application began to show up in the ECS area. And the journal gained with it, so that it went from the three manuscripts to where I was, or three papers published, to where I was fielding 600 to 700 manuscripts a year. Mm-hmm. Particularly by the time I'd gone to Rice, it was at least that big.
What was your rejection rate? How did that fare over that time?
It wasn't too inconstant. I would say it stayed at about 20% of true rejections, and there were maybe 10% where authors were decided to withdraw. So I guess we published 6 to 7 out of every 10 we got. And it was lower at first and higher later, because people began to understand that they were getting scrutinized. They didn't submit papers that couldn't stand scrutiny.
Okay.
That's a fairly standard. I'm sure we got rejects from other journals at the beginning. But they got standard peer review by people in the field. This is before there was a certain amount of feeling of insecurity with some peer looking at your fresh work. Well, currently, people who write proposals are constantly concerned about the work being lifted. Same with papers, it's not as bad because they're a year behind everything else. But at first, the peer review was indeed just exactly that. People did look at it. They looked at it carefully, thoughtfully, and not with any other intention except to have nothing but the best stuff in the literature. Now, that's a different matter, but there are variations on that theme now which are disturbing.
In what way?
Well, it leads to turning down papers that perhaps ought to be massaged further and used. It leads to having ideas ahead of time rather than behind time. It leads to the kind of thing that Neil Gordon was trying to develop when he set up the Gibson Island conferences that became the Gordon conferences, namely conversations between peers from universities and from industry and government, without recorders, without photography, just talk, no notes. And the general understanding was that you would not go out and talk about this stuff until it appeared as a publication somewhere.